Machete Mate recognizes the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and any indigenous elders of other communities who may be listening today. We stand in solidarity in their struggle towards the colonization and land back. Buena mi gente, what is good? This is Machete Mate back with I think this is three episodes in a row that we're doing. Because usually it wouldn't be us if we weren't taking like long breaks between episodes. But here we are again, recording, back to back at least. It's going to be a little bit different as well, because it's not going to necessarily be a current events episode. It's going to be a comrade conversation with someone that we definitely look to a lot, especially when it comes to on-the-ground stuff that's going on in Puerto Rico, you know, our beloved Matria of Puerto Rico. So we're super excited to have this person on. You know, we've had friend of the show, Paul Figueroa, on before with El PIP, so the Independence Party of Puerto Rico. But this, I think, is a little bit of a different dynamic here, because Paul's perspective is, you know, invaluable, but it's very, you know, top-down sort of electoral, you know, like partisan. Whereas this, I think, is going to be more bottom-up, you know, people in the streets and stuff like that. I think both perspective has a place in what we're trying to talk about, we're trying to, you know, illustrate whatever. But we'll get to that. I'm Leroy, coming to you from unceded Wurundjeri land with the homie Austin, who looks like he's about to die. What's going on, Austin?
Yeah, man, I'm sick as a dog, which, Leroy, you mentioned before we started recording, it might be just, I don't know, withdrawals from being back from Puerto Rico. I don't know. I miss it already. I wish I was still there. That would make me very happy. But no, I'm still happy to be here to record. And like you said, three in a row puts a smile on my extremely sick face.
100%. And like we said, it's probably the Luma got him. Because just to let you know, like when he was in Puerto Rico, Luma showed up like on his street to do something. And 100%, they shot him with like a radiation gun or something, because they knew what was up. Because they listened to the podcast, the CIA is involved in this, and you know how it is. But anyway, unfortunately, T couldn't make it, which is fine. We're going without him. We love you, dude. But yeah, like I said at the top, special guest, someone we look to for all things Puerto Rico on the street. I'm a big fan of his work. Carlos Berrio Polanco. What's good, man?
Hey, y'all. Thanks for having me. Excited to talk with y'all.
Like I said, it's awesome to have you on, man. But before we get into the meat potato of the episode, just a quick vibe check. Carlos, what's up? What's good? How you doing? How's life?
I'm good. I'm a little tired. I was telling y'all a bit before. I came from Campamento Pelicano today. I went and visited there and ran them up some tourniquets and other medical gear, and then came back.
Oh, shit.
Drinking my very cold Starbucks coffee. And that's life. Looking forward to the weekend, I'll be honest with you. I just want to sleep in and do nothing.
My man is from Puerto Rico drinking Starbucks, like where we actually grow coffee and everything, and like we're very proud of our coffee, and this man is drinking Starbucks. Terrible. Anyway, Austin, what's good, man?
Oh, man. I just echoing Carlos here and saying that I am extremely looking forward to, at least, I guess, attempting to sleep in on this weekend, right? Like I did, as I mentioned, did a lot of, I guess, a decent amount of traveling in the last week. Came back from Puerto Rico earlier this week and was feeling not sick, right? Was obviously sad to leave Puerto Rico, but was feeling not sick. This morning, I just woke up with just a hellaciously just a bad pain in my throat. It was, of course, having the thought of, oh, wow, could this in fact be the Rona? Took a test, negative, so your boy is not COVID positive, so that's at least good, but still trying to hang in there. But this recording is for sure bringing up my spirits. How about you, Leroy? How are your vibes today?
Nah, same old. Like, unlike y'all, like, I have no prospects of sleep. I have a 4-year-old autistic child, so that takes up like 24/7. It's all good though. We just bought him a new bed, like a kind of a smaller bed, but a big boy bed type of thing. So that's looking forward to building that for him and bunch of other stuff. My garden is doing great. The weather just turned shit randomly. We're still technically in summer down here in Australia, but Melbourne's Melbourne, so the weather shit's rainy and cold and whatever. But it is what it is. But yeah, look, let's just get into it. We'll try to keep it nice and tidy so we can get the most out of Carlos, because his perspectives are going to be very, very valuable. Definitely something we want to get to and maximize our time with him. So, Carlos, why don't we kick it off? Just like talk a little bit about yourself. Like, what do you do? Like, where are you from? Like, basically, why do you think that we have you here? Why do you think that we look to your work so much?
Well, I'm the Caribbean correspondent for the digital newspaper Latino Rebels. I cover mostly environmentalism, privatization, colonialism, street movements here in Puerto Rico. I'm from Caguas, pretty much born and raised. Except I was born in San Juan, but I don't really tell people that because I'm forever. and mostly just because I've been, at least from my understanding, up until like 2 days ago, I've been one of the few people covering the environmentalist protests and land privatization in Puerto Rico in English.
Yeah.
Kind of. Fairly, other than like the occasional article here and there, I've been at most of the protests. Tried to keep track of things mostly. I think that's my claim to fame right now.
No, I think that's important though. I think that's why we sort of look to you for some of this stuff, because you do provide a lot of the good stuff that's happening on the island in English, right? Like we're both bilingual, Austin and I, but like a lot of the people a lot of the political circles and the people we talk to aren't, you only know English. So we can sort of point to your work and be like, this is stuff that you can like look at, like important stuff that's actually happening there. But before we get too into it, like a question I like to ask people that we bring on, because a lot of the times we bring on people who are from the diaspora, who have a connection to like somewhere in Latin America, is to basically paint a picture for us of what they're talking about. So like for you being in Puerto Rico, like when you think of Puerto Rico, like what do you, like what comes to mind? Like what are the colors like? What is the smell like? What's the emotion? Because, you know, Puerto Ricans, we tend to be very nostalgic about the island. Even if we're there, we still have these like nostalgic, like sort of views of Puerto Rico. Like paint a picture for us. Like what comes to mind in your mind?
You know, this might kind of be a little bit of a canned answer, but I would say the sazón on the wind, like being able to smell the food pretty much wherever you are. There's like a distinct kind of smell and taste to the atmosphere. Like literally the wind in a lot of places just smells like home, like what to us is home cooking. Yeah. Right, you might be at like the beach and you could smell it wafting down from like houses near the beach, or you might be in the mountains and you'll smell it down from houses in the mountains, right? And yeah, that's mostly what, when I think of Puerto Rico in those terms, that's mostly what comes to mind for me.
That's see, like I try to tell people that, like it has a certain smell, like once you're there, so like you get off the plane and like just the humidity hits you, and then like the smell of the ocean. And like of like you said, el sazón just in the air, just there. And people think like, why are you so proud? Like, why are you so always looking back? Like, it's just, it's not something you choose to like be connected to. It's just you can't help but maintaining that connection to a place. Like, even if you've never lived there, or like just, it's, I think it's just that generational like connection to the place. You know what I mean? Which is why I guess our struggle against colonization is so strong, because, you know, it's La Matria, right? That's, you know, our homeland, right? But anyway, we'll sort of get into it. This week, shit's been going down in my home, Aguadilla. Talking about beautiful corners of Puerto Rico. Aguadilla is absolutely beautiful. You've been there, if not every day, but most days. And like you said, you're probably one of the other ones covering it in English. Like, your stuff has been all over the internet, all over Twitter, all over Latino Rebels, whatever. Can you just talk a little bit about what happened earlier this week?
So earlier this week, environmental activists and protesters organized kind of a family beach day at what is legally public land in Aguadilla, in Cueva Las Golondrinas, which is an area that environmentalists have been fighting for a lot since 2018. because this private company, Aguadilla Pier Corp, built a gazebo and a paddock for horses on top of the cave, which many, many people say has damaged the structure of the cave. And they've also kind of fenced it off, so you can't go in there if you're like a regular person. And many argued before 2022 that that was public land. And effectively, their demands led to the DRNA to investigate, the Department of Natural and Environmental Resources, to investigate and then order a demolition order for those two buildings built on top of Las Condrinas, because they were essentially built on public land that should be freely accessible to the public. And this company, Aguadilla Pier Corp, has been fighting that demolition order since it was issued, and they don't let anybody in. Like, I've been inside once or twice when I went with a large group of people after it was kind of like closed off, right? But these environmental activists cobbled together kind of like a little fleet of speedboats and kayaks to take them to this area in Cueva Las Condrinas through the water. So they organized at a crash boat, which is a beach near there, and then sailed to El Muelle de Azúcar, which is right next to Cueva Las Condrinas.
Yep.
They came out of the boats. They walk up this like small hill, which had been closed off with these kind of like concrete jersey barriers that the activists moved. And they reach this fence, and they're kind of there like, hey, this is our land. The DRNA already said that it's our land. Why are these structures still here? And there's a bunch of security guards there who, from what I've been told by activists, were already kind of like a little bit hyper. There is this interaction with security activists, and security pepper sprays a bunch of activists. Activists respond with rocks, and then... And this is like to, and this needs to be cleared up because it's not super clear from what I've seen in English. Activists did throw rocks in response to getting attacked themselves. And then security guards moved back into the gazebo and the paddock. And then one of the security guards opened fire, or at least one. We still don't know if there was more than one. Opened fire with live bullets on the activists. Reportedly 15 or more shots were fired. One shot hit an activist through the left leg, a little bit above the ankle, and he was also grazed by another bullet. For what I was hearing today from activists was that he felt a piece of like concrete hit him, and then he was grazed by a bullet, and then he looked down and saw the bullet hitting him, which is when he tried to like continue walking and fell. And then he was carried off by other activists into one of the civilian speedboats and then hurried off to emergency medical services. But in this location that is legally public land, security guards opened fire on protesters, and most of them were outside of the fenced in area, which shouldn't make a difference because it's all public. But they were outside of this fencing area. Security guards opened fire. And then that's when the police comes, and then riot police show up, arrest six activists as they're moving forward to push people out of the area. And they reportedly arrest this one security guard, one of the ones who fired, but they let other security guards go. There's one very kind of famous picture going around of a security guard with a gun pointed at people with an orange slide. That's the one that was shooting either pepper balls or rubber bullets at people. But to my understanding, he was not arrested. The only security guard who was arrested was one of the ones who reportedly shot at activists, and the others were let go. And there's several videos taken by community reporters on the ground and Surfrider Puerto Rico that show these security guards just walking past police. Pretty much like there was one that somebody shared with me today where you can just kind of see the guy coming out of the paddock.
Yeah. And to be clear, these are private security guards, right? This is not the actual police, correct?
Yeah. So to Yeah, these are private security guards, not actual police. Police were in the area, to be clear. There were more than a dozen cruisers in very close to the area where people were protesting and two police boats in the water. But the people who opened fire on activists were private security hired by Agua de Yapía Corp.
Yeah. And I think, just quickly, Austin, before I jump in, to be clear, I guess to paint a picture of Agua Villa is in the northwesternmost point of Puerto Rico. So it's basically bordered by water on two sides. So the easiest way in and out, just like Carlos was saying, was probably by speedboat or by canoe or kayak, whatever, because otherwise you have to sort of go through, you know what I mean? Just to paint a picture, it's beachside, a lot of water. And yeah, Austin, go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. Like, I don't want to get too off the track from the actual events of what happened on the ground there, but I'm really curious, right? And since, you know, you mentioned the local police as well, what has the role of like the local municipal government been, if at all, right? Because you mentioned essentially federal authorities, like U.S. authorities being the ones saying Agua de Yapía Corps, no, this is public land. You guys got to stop what you're doing. Have local authorities just been like, oh, well, you know, I guess what, like, are we going to, like, are they helping enforce at all? Like, are they just not caring? Like, cause like I would have to, and I know things are like complicated and fucked up on the ground sometimes, but like, I wonder, like with private security, literally shooting at people, like, does the local municipality like not care? Or like, I don't know if that's a thing at all. I'd be curious to know.
Oh, so I think I wasn't super clear. So the EPA is currently in kind of a litigation process with Agua de Yapía Corp for not doing well with the Clean Water Act. But it wasn't federal authorities, federal, like U.S. federal authorities, but the Puerto Rican government authorities who gave the demolition order for Cueva Las Golondrinas. But as far as the municipal government goes, the mayor of Aguadilla has been kind of very silent on this issue. After the shooting, he put out a very brief statement saying that he filed for an injunction for the demolition order and that viewing is supposed to be in February. But there are some kind of local Aguadilla politicians who are just like, hey, what's going on here? There's nothing, right? That should have already been resolved because the DRNA gave the order to demolish. And I should have added this earlier, but there are two constructions in that area of Aguadilla. There is Aguadilla Pier Corp, which is mostly the bottom of that area, right? And this company operates, right, that space with the paddock and the gazebo and the Muelle de Azúcar, which is an old, how do you say muelle in English?
Like pier? Wharf?
Yeah, which is another an old pier. And then,
Let me just jump in there. Being from Aguadilla, that's been there forever. You know what I mean? It's a landmark that's just part of the landscape. You know what I mean? So the thought of it being closed off or like privatized anyway, it's like privatizing the sky. You know what I mean? Like, that's what it feels like. Sorry for jumping in.
No, it's all good. So Aguadilla Pier Corp is in that area, and the demolition order, which is another kind of controversy, is supposed to demolish, right? Activists wanted to just demolish those two structures, but the demolition order includes El Muelle de Azúcar and the molasses tank as well. And then there is the second company called The Cliff, which is trying to build a series of like Airbnb / hotels / apartments in that same area above where the Agua de Yapía Corp does their thing, and they're both owned by the same person, Carlos Roman Gonzalez. As the construction of the cliff was given a stoppage order at the same time the demolition order was issued back in May of 2022. But as I've personally witnessed, and as activists have seen who've been there, construction continues, right? I was in a press conference yesterday with one of the activists, and the activist was literally saying, someone sent me a video of construction happening right now, right? So the construction continues even if the stoppage order is in place. And as part of the part that local police have played overall, right, after There was another attack by private security on people who were staying. They kind of made a camp outside of the construction, which I'll get more into later. The activists tried to stop a truck from coming in, and then, right, because they were trying to do the job that the government's supposed to do and stop them from continuing to build. And then security comes out of the truck, reportedly brandishes a knife, then lets the knife go, then brandishes a baton and beats two protesters. Right. And after that, they tried to form a makeshift barricade, which I went to see the next day.
Yeah.
And then a day or two after that, police came in and swept that area out so that people could come in and out of that construction area. Right. So today, right before I got there today, I saw a video of a truck coming in with these concrete jersey barriers. And while I was there, I saw the truck coming out, and they told me that two trucks came in today with an escort of police motorcycles. So essentially, knowing that this demolition and stoppage order is in place, the police are still allowing that to go on, right? And they set up the orange barriers to divide kind of the camp, and then police have their own camp to make sure that cars and trucks can come in and out without any problem.
Yeah, that's absurd. And all of this is in the service of capital. And on that note, can you just talk about like why this is happening? I guess in the bigger scheme of, you know, the, you know, La Ley 60 with all the, you know, the opportunity zones and everything, like why is this being allowed to happen? And like, what's the bigger thing at play here in terms of like neoliberalism in the context of colonialism and all that stuff?
Well, first, I think that the answer I most give is that beachfront property is big business in Puerto Rico. If you can get yourself a little like Airbnb hotel rent, short-term rental in front of the beach, you're going to make a lot of money. And a recent report came out that this company got about $3 million in government funding or whatever. So it's essentially kind of a privatization and destruction of natural resources to benefit the economy. But the money that generates often doesn't go back into these communities, as we've seen in pretty much any place that has any beachfront place that's famous for their beaches. These kind of small hubs of rich people form, and then they kind of stay in that barrier in those areas, and the money doesn't circulate out of these communities. Right in Dorado, it's very famous for their beautiful beaches and also the amount of rich foreigners and even rich Puerto Ricans that move into the area and have kind of made that their own little zone, a part of Dorado. Right, it's a system, and this applies everywhere in Puerto Rico, a system of exploitation of not only the natural resources, but the people in the area, because this construction has taken the path of the ancient public train that used to run for the area, as well as land that belonged to neighbors there. So if you see pictures from before and after, you'll see that the gate that the construction set up is in like other people's yards, essentially.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, especially within the context of Aguadilla, like we have what used to be called Remy Air Force Base, right? It's an Air Force Base that was built by the U.S. government in Aguadilla that was essentially built through eminent domain. Basically, they came and said, everyone that lived there, we're going to give you something, but you need to leave, right? And my family, my grandfather's family used to live on part of the site. There's the El Poblado or El Barrio de San Antonio that they had to basically pick up like this entire like little neighborhood and just move it along to build this sort of Air Force Base. So I suppose within the last 120, 25, 130 years of U.S. colonialism in Puerto Rico, there is that precedent of, you know, gringos coming in and just sort of taking the land that they want without regard to what's there and who's there. But I suppose that's just what you come to expect with colonialism, right? But yeah, so that's really important to sort of set the scene of what's going on in Puerto Rico. I mean, we've talked about at length about what's going on in Puerto Rico in terms of, you know, U.S. capital, neoliberalism, all the little laws that are meant to, quote unquote, facilitate investment. in light of, you know, the crippling debt, but we know what that's about, right? But I guess going back further, before the Aguadilla things, we're also in the crisis of electricity, right, in Puerto Rico, stemming, I mean, people use, like, talk about Maria, and, you know, Maria is a thing that triggered it, but this, again, is part of the big machine of colonialism, right? We've talked at length as well about Luma coming in and just hiking up prices just because capitalism, right? But recently, it's been announced that there's been a contract made with a company called Genera Puerto Rico for the generation of the electricity, whereas Luma's more the supplier, right? They're more the distributor, and this is going to be the generator, right? What sort of role has that played, or like what's been going on there?
So Luma Energy is in charge of distribution, transmission, and repair of the electrical grid, and what was recently privatized is the generation of electrical power by Genera PR, which is a subsidiary of New Fortress Energy, which supplies natural gas to one of the electrical plants in Puerto Rico, right? And the Genera PR would privatize pretty much everything that used to belong to the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority. And this, people have been talking about this for years, right? As yeah. far back as I can remember, the privatization of electricity has been a huge talking point. And with the privatization of half of the electrical grid in 2021, we saw, like, what happens when you privatize a public service by a company that isn't used to and isn't ready to deal with what an archipelago like Puerto Rico needs, or its electrical needs. And now we're seeing Genera PR taking over generation of the electrical grid. And this was all kind of done very, right? There had been rumblings before, but this was kind of very much done behind closed doors. Like, even I was a little surprised when they made that announcement, having been in this world. I was like, wait, that was, like, startlingly quick how that happened. But we're seeing kind of what is essentially happening, right? And I want to link it all together because it is part of that same, like, colonialist overtaking of everything framework. We're seeing the privatization of everything that is public, right? The public electricity, the public beaches is what we're seeing. We're kind of seeing how Puerto Ricans are losing access to things that are, like, rightfully theirs, which is a huge part of colonialism, right? But so far, reportedly, they're supposed to start mid. Genera PR is supposed to start mid-year. I mean, it's still so. PREPA is still in its debt restructuring process in the courts, and it is currently kind of unclear how that debt restructuring is going to impact Genera PR. What I can tell you, though, is that the contract that Luma signed last year is dependent on this debt restructuring coming through, because they're currently paying a higher per year price for Luma than the 15-year contract that they wanted to originally sign, because the contract states that you can't get this 15-year contract until PREPA's debt restructuring is done. So we're kind of seeing Puerto Ricans paying a lot of money for things that aren't functioning as they should. I know on the podcast you've talked about all of the many, many blackouts that we've experienced here.
Yeah.
And part of the... Oh, sorry. You can go ahead.
No, I was going to say that I read a thing that the blackouts that occur in Puerto Rico are 5 times higher than, like, the industry average. So, like, blackouts are going to happen in a system that's electrified, right? But in Puerto Rico, those blackouts happen 5 times more often than they do in Puerto Rico. And I think you said something that was very, very important, that it doesn't really matter if we privatize this or we bring these people in to, you know, to work on the generation or whatever, when the infrastructure in place to deal with this is shit. You know what I mean? Like, maybe at the moment, like we've talked about at length as well about like the medical system, quote unquote, the medical system in Puerto Rico. Like Vieques doesn't even have a hospital. You know what I mean? It'd be like if we brought in Puerto Rico, brought in like these medical experts to reform the healthcare system without there actually being anything in place to reform. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to get into it, but this is, I mean, this is a blatant racket. Like, you can't tell me that, you know, El PNP, the pro-statehood party, is willingly paying more than what it should be if they're not getting a cut at the other side, right? This is a skim off the top that they're putting in their own pockets. I'm getting into conspiracy theory sort of area, but there's no other way I can see it.
Here's the thing, it's not a conspiracy, Leroy, if it's the truth. My goodness. No, but what I was going to say is, you know, you mentioned the blackouts, Carlos, and I think, Leroy, correct me if I'm wrong, I think when I was in Puerto Rico last year, did we record while I was blacked out for one of my we did like a Patreon exclusive while I was blacked out something. All right, and like blacked out mid-recording, something like that.
No. I think there was a blackout and you had just come out and it was like a last minute thing if you were going to be able to record or not because you were like mid-blackout. And you're like, okay, the power's back. I can record.
Yeah, and that leads me to something I was gonna ask, right? If I recall correctly, I think that might have been, I think I was there for the last like full like archipelago-wide blackout. What has the frequency been like lately? Like, has it like kind of, is it not as bad as it was before? Is it kind of like I said, I think that was the last time that was the whole archipelago, but I could be mistaken.
No, I think that was right. When were you here?
It was spring of, well, by U.S. seasons, I guess, spring of last year. It was like March, April.
Oh no, there was a bigger one, or not a bigger one. Right, that one in the spring was, I think, the biggest to date. But there were big ones in August and September, and those. But there was actually a kind of a big one. I believe it was Wednesday around like 10 or 11. I believe like 30,000 customers lost electricity. But I think lately there have not been as big blackouts, right? That one that we're mentioning, the huge one was ridiculous, right? A lot of the main island was without power for for a couple days, especially right in the southwest is one of the places that's most affected by the blackouts. When I was there covering post Fiona, the places there took weeks for electricity to come back versus like the metro where it came back relatively quickly. But in the past few weeks, I think that one on Wednesday is the biggest that I could I can recall, though.
Yeah, I was gonna say on that same vein, like obviously because of all this and because people are aware of the material conditions, Luma is incredibly unpopular. Like people want to, you know, get rid of Luma. And as such, there's just been countless, like dozens and dozens and dozens of protests that you've covered. Like, can you just talk a little bit about those, like the frequency, like what are you seeing on the ground? Like, what's the general feeling of these protests? If it's sort of, are they just protesting or angry at Luma? Or is there sort of a bigger consciousness thereof? Like, this is linked to like U.S. colonialism and capitalism and all that.
Well, lately there haven't been any protests because if you have the longest Christmas in the world, people feel kind of a lot better, right? But before there were about weekly, I want to say, if you don't count the cacerolazos, which I mean, in some places were happening every day for a while. Yeah. Right there. And it's kind of difficult to gauge, right? I think most people have kind of like this sense or this conscious that it is more than just the privatization of electricity. But as far as that going into like the right, everyone in Puerto Rico, I would wager to say, are like 90% have a sense that the colonial state of things is like, right, being a colony of the United States is not where it's at, right? And which is why you see people wanting statehood, wanting independence, and right, the PPD is kind of floundering a little bit. And by a little bit, I mean a lot of it. Yeah. Right, which is why you see we've seen these kind of like bigger shifts towards one side or the other lately. And I think people know that the status of things is not, it is like a larger a larger part of what's happening, but I don't know if they would, most people would necessarily link it. And I'm talking like not people who attend protests, but the quote unquote regular Puerto Rican would specifically link it to as an after effect of colonialism specifically. But I think more and more people are kind of understanding how the U.S. imposition is what's bringing us these blackouts and these privatizations and the rising cost of electricity. And not just, right, I think a lot of like the colonialism that any place suffers is kind of obscured in bureaucracy, right?
Yeah,
you see the physical effects, the blackouts and not having enough food, depending on right how much you make. But a lot of that is paperwork, right? I was at a protest on Wednesday when the federal court was doing the thing for the PREPA debt restructuring, where they want to input about a specific tax over 50 years. I believe it's, I should have looked this up beforehand, my bad, but I believe it was $300 per month for the next 50 years increase in electricity to pay the bondholders of PREPA's debt, right? So you kind of see this worsening of the material conditions, the quality of life through bureaucracy. And I think a lot more people are kind of waking up to how that's done versus just privatization.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting to hear. Like, I'm curious, like, how, bring us a little bit further back here, you know, I was curious to ask as well, like, how this also ties into, once again, we were talking about Hedera, right? Like, and how, like, how did this even happen? Like, did... Because I saw announcements were essentially that Pierre Luisi just like basically said it's happening. Like, was it that simple? Did he have to introduce a law? Like, or is it like all a part of like the debt restructuring process that grants the governor power to just say, fuck you guys, this is what's happening? Like, I'm curious to know.
Right. So it's part of the debt restructuring process. When PREPA announced it was in debt and couldn't pay off those debts, that kicked in the kind of rush to sell pieces of it off to pay this debt. So it's part of that debt restructuring process. But like I was saying, specifically for Hinera, it was done significantly more behind closed doors than kind of like the Luma sell-off, right? Because like I genuinely, right, I knew it was happening because, you know, people talk, rumors spread, all that, but it was like genuinely a little bit shocking to me how that kind of got announced. One day it wasn't there, and then another day there are all of these plans in motion, right? And we'll see if they actually start mid-year, because it's unclear, right, all of this debt stuff, how it's going to play out.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, talking about Pierluisi as well, he's, if we rewind, like, he came to power essentially after the 2019 Henrique Renuncia protests. And we've talked about it as well. Like, it's unfortunate that, like, you had this mass mobilization of people coming out in protest, which was, you know, incredible to see. But the PMP, the Pro-Statehood Party, was still, you know, reelected, albeit with like the smallest, with barely a third of the vote. We saw the NVC and the PIP, the Independence Party, and the, you know, we call it like the big tent sort of progressive party coming in at like 13, 14, 15%, which is, you know, unheard of if you know anything about the history of Puerto Rican like partisan politics. What's your sense, you know, around that? What's your sense of like the political arena going forward, whether it's partisan, whether it's, you know, people that have any sort of, you know, increasing apathy towards like the whole political the political game at play? Like, what do you see going forward? Like, what's your sense on the ground?
Well, I think, right, the 2019 is like a historic, there was a before and then there was an after, right? And I think,
yeah,
before there was kind of apathy of kind of like leftist groups on the island. And after, they've really gained a groundswell of support with the PIP and the MBC, right? And now that they're kind of attempting to partner up, we're seeing the after effects of the groundswell of support they gained in 2019 and have been gaining, right? So I think post 2019, we're seeing people moving to either side. We're seeing more people going towards these kind of like left electoral groups, political parties, and we're also seeing more people moving towards these right kind of a little bit more extreme and like political extreme, like Proyecto Dignidad and the PNP. So we're kind of seeing the hollowing in my opinion, right? We're seeing the hollowing out of people who are in the middle, and we're seeing people moving to either end of like what is electorally available for these coming elections. And personally, I do see, right, both of these parties getting more support in the upcoming gubernatorial elections. And, right, I'm not a guy who knows a lot about how electoral politics work, but I'm seeing people significantly smarter than me saying that there is kind of a real possibility that in the 2028 elections, we see an upset based on the amount of support that these groups have been, or these, the MBC and the PEEP have been getting, especially now that they're kind of attempting to join forces, even though, right, there's certain laws in place that say that political parties can't work together in certain ways, that the PEEP and the MBC are trying to figure out a way to deal with and move around.
Yeah, which is quite interesting, because in the rest of Latin America, there's just a whole host of parties called Frente Amplio, whatever, which is just like broad fronts of like similar, you know, ideological parties. And again, the fact that that can't happen in Puerto Rico is 100% a vestige of, you know, colonialism that exists there. And I think for a bit of context as well, the pervasive narrative and the pervasive meme about the independence parties or any sort of third party is the fact that like they're unpopular. They can't even break 3%. So when we say that the fact that like they got like 15% in the last election is massive, that's a massive, you know, result. Obviously, it's nowhere near the majority, it's nowhere near, you know, the numbers that they would need to get elected. But like going from a party that eventually barely exists to a lot of people to being a prominent, like, actual force is huge. And like, what you see is a lot of the people in the pro statehood party, the PMP, the moribund PPD party, right, the status quo party, that I don't understand like how it exists, because like you said, like, there's a hollowing out of like that middle. Like, as far as I'm concerned, there won't be a party for much longer, except for like the older generations who still have that loyalty to like Luis Muñoz Marín, you know what I mean, that they still invoke that. And that's a whole different conversation. But I think it's huge what we're seeing. I think it's very, very important for our movements.
Yeah, the thing I was most, maybe optimistic is a strong word, but hopeful for when the MVC was being formed was that hopefully it would bring the death of the Populares. I guess that remains to be seen at this point, the PPD, right? But I think you're right, Carlos, in saying that I think a lot of the strategy, at least from what I see, is kind of aiming toward an upset in 2028, right? As much as I want to believe that a joint ticket with Dalmau at the head could win in 2024, right? That's going to be a difficult challenge, right? I think the very winnable race with a joint ticket in 2024 is Natal in San Juan, right? And if Natal won in San Juan, you already know he'll try to run for governor in 2028, or MVC will try to promote somebody. But who knows? Now it's way long down the road, and that's speculation, people, right? We don't know what's going to happen. But yeah, no, I was also curious to know on this note, and we don't want to take up too much of your time here, but kind of like tying a little bit of this together, I was curious to know, have any of the, like, I guess like more progressive electoral parties, right? We mentioned the Independence Party or the Movimiento Victoria Ciudadana. Have any of them been like involved with what's going on in Aguadilla or any of the other protests on the ground? Or are they mostly just like on the ground activist led sort of things?
Well, the camp in Aguadilla, Campamento Pelicano, was founded by Mariana Nogales Molinetti, representative of the Citizens Victory Movement. And she, in an interview we did, she was like, well, I built this camp after running out of like legal avenues to get this done. She was saying that, you know, you exhaust all these legal pipelines, so all you have left is these like civil actions and civil disobedience. to do. So she's been a very prominent supporter of these kind of environmental activism protests throughout, right? Not just in Aguadilla, but everywhere on the island. And it bears to say that most of these encampments form on the northwest of Puerto Rico. And we've also seen, right, as far as like physically being at these environmental protests, we've seen the PEEP. We've seen more of the MVC than the PEEP, but we've seen support from both parties for the environmentalism on the island. But as far as physically being there, it's mostly been MVC support. It is mostly environmental activists who are doing this kind of work of setting up or of showing up and setting up shop at these camps and working to bring attention to these to the destruction of natural resources.
Real quick, I was just gonna say I think we've seen our boy Eliezer Molina out there. You already know he's gonna be out there in these protests.
He has, yeah. No, I mean, he's pretty much everywhere, always live.
Yeah, and he's no stranger to Aguadilla because he was out there a couple of months ago when they were gonna build what's it called on the, like it's hard for me to think of how to describe it with to people who are not familiar with Aguadilla, but anyway, they're going to destroy this entire section of Aguadilla to build like a you know more structures or whatever, and he was out there trying to protect it. He got arrested. He's a little bit of a he's never seen a camera he doesn't like. He's a bit like that, but to his credit, he's out there. He's, you know, front and center, you know, bringing attention, which is very, very interesting. But going back to, like, the environmental activists are in Aguadilla, like, is this a network of people across the islands, or are we seeing, like, just little pockets of people popping up?
Very much so a network of people now, right? Because these camps gained prominence with the camp that was formed in Rincón. Way back when, and that at that point it was very much pockets of people that then came together in Rincón and then became this network throughout the island, right? I visited many of these camps, I believe 4 or 5 at this point, and some of them no longer exist because they were temporary or they won, like in Rincón. But you tend to see the same people, right? You tend to see a group that's from that area being kind of the mainstays at the camp, but you tend to see the same people going from camp to camp, right? I remember being at Campamento Murciélago in Arecibo, which was made to protest the privatization and destruction of Cueva del Indio right on the coast, and seeing the same person that I had seen the day before, or not the same person, a couple of the same people I had seen the day before in Aguadilla, right? And then they were talking about going to the second camp in Rincón, Campamento Semí, which was made to protest this kind of restaurant hotel thing that built an illegal drainage pipe that was dumping sewage onto like a playground and the beach. Right. So it started as these pockets of people that have now become a network of activists throughout the island. Right. And a lot of that has been because of these kind of like live streams, like right anytime you're there, you see someone with a phone, they're likely, or anytime that anything happens, everyone's first instinct is I gotta go live, right? Yeah. And you see how these live streams spread the not only the message but the actions and what's happening at these camps that has led more people to mobilize for these environmental causes.
Oh yeah, and on that note, do you think this is gonna grow? Do you think it's like a snowball effect? Like people are gonna get connected, and it's gonna grow bigger and bigger and bigger, or do you sort of see it just a sort of a small network of people?
Oh, absolutely, I see it snowballing significantly more than it is now. Right, I was talking to one activist in Aguadilla earlier today who was telling me that before he never really fought of doing something like this until he started like seeing the live streams, and he was like, well, I gotta be there, right? I gotta support I gotta fight against the privatization of our natural resources. And I especially see it growing right after the shooting on Sunday, how I think that the not only were the people who were there kind of solidified in their commitment to protecting the natural resources, right? But I think many people are going to be, one, horrified that that's being done to people who just kind of want to exist in spaces that are legally public, but also like going to be inspired by the fact that these people were in mortal danger, right? By they, everyone there was extremely lucky that a stray bullet didn't catch them. But they, I think that's going to be very inspiring for a lot of people going forward. The type of civil disobedience that is what a very small group of people against seemingly a giant group of moneyed individuals and the power of the state.
Yeah, 100%. And like on that note as well, like I remember telling my mom about this. I was having that guadilla earlier this week, and my mom's family, they're old school PNP, like pro statehood party, fairly conservative and everything. And even I was telling her, I'm like, oh, you know, esto pasó en Aguadilla. Like, this is happening at Aguadilla. She goes, ¿cómo va a ser? Like, what, are you serious? And blah, blah, blah. She was trying to contact, you know, friends in Aguadilla. And she couldn't find anything. Like, there was no barely any local reporting on it. Like, no one was talking about it, you know, except for you, except for like Latino rebels or whatever. So I kept linking her to those things. But my point being that even people who are sensibly like traditionally would be, you know, scoffing at the protests or whatever are sort of seeing like, hey, like I might not agree with certain tactics or here or there, but like, you know, this is, you know, these are our beaches, you know, this is our, you know, our land, this is, you know, belongs to us. Like if I want to be a stay or not, you know, that's irrelevant. Like these people coming into our area, you know, harming us, you know what I mean? So I think that's super interesting and super hopeful, I suppose, as well. And I guess one, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I wanted to say that I think one of the things that has played a large role in mobilizing people is the image of heavily armored riot police attacking people in bikinis and board shorts, right? You see what one group that is very much like, I am here to have fun versus essentially a stormtrooper. And that I think has mobilized a lot of people to be like, well, regardless of like where I stand politically, that's wrong.
Yeah, right? And 100%.
That's what's mobilized a lot of people to come out. Not maybe not the day-to-day stuff, but if there's an event announced, that mobilized a lot of people to come out.
Yeah, 100%. Especially in Aguadilla, because like I said before, you know, El Muelle de Azúcar has been there forever. It's part of the landscape of Aguadilla. You mentioned Crash Boat. Everybody in Puerto Rico knows Crash Boat. You know what? It's just an incredible beach that is slowly, piece by piece, being privatized and sold off. And for the average person in Aguadilla, that's unthinkable and unacceptable, because, you know, that's one of the things we're proud of, right? Like, we have stickers, we have, you know, we make t-shirts. That's Crash Boat synonymous with our Aguadillaness, I suppose. So I think that's, I hate to say, you know, it's a good thing, but at least it's serving to, you know, sort of wake up a lot of the people who would just normally allow the privatization of other parts of the island go by. When they can see that happen to them, something that's close to them, you know, they see it happening in that realm, they can sort of tie it, you know, Puerto Rico wide. But I suppose, like, I wanted to ask you as well, like, what do you say to people? Especially get a lot of people, a lot of, you know, gringos outside of Puerto Rico talk about tourism. Oh, you know, tourism's good for the, you know, the economy and blah, 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 blah. When we see, you know, the effects of that concept of, you know, eco-tourist economy in Puerto Rico and this being the reality to build the infrastructure. Like, what do you say to those people who are like, well, you know, they're helping the economy or whatever?
Well, it's the thing about tourism and a lot of these quote-unquote tourism that helps the economy end up staying at hotels or like private hotels or whatever, where that economy and the money doesn't circulate. Like, you pay whatever you pay at the hotel, and maybe you go to one restaurant in the town or whatever if you're feeling a little adventurous, but that money doesn't spread to the community, right? It stays in that hotel, which is either owned or like either way, it's owned by someone who already has a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it doesn't pass on to like the local people, because that's not the way that the system of tourism in that way that happens in Puerto Rico and in these hotels and Airbnbs, it doesn't, isn't conducive to that wealth spreading from a person who comes here. Right. And that's part of, right, the problem with Airbnb as well, which is a huge thing right now. Most of, I believe it's like 70 or 80% of the Airbnbs in Puerto Rico are owned by less than 10 companies or something. So you see that in action as well. You say, oh, well, I'm not staying at a fancy hotel. I'm staying at a quote unquote local Airbnb, but then it's one of these Airbnbs that is owned by this kind of like apartment managing company or whatever. So that money doesn't go to the community. It goes to the people who own these Airbnbs. So, right. This is something that has been stressed to me by many activists. They're not against people coming to enjoy the beaches from out of Puerto Rico. They're not against tourists. What they're against is the exploitation and privatization of these natural resources, right? What
100%
they want is to have the same access as somebody who's paying, the same access to these natural resources and these beaches as somebody who is paying for them, because many, well, I would wager say most Puerto Ricans don't have the money necessary to pay for one of these fancy Airbnbs or hotels, right? In Dorado, the beach there that they were trying to privatize, and I actually haven't heard much from that beach, is a quote-unquote private beach that you only have access to if you're staying at one of these hotels that costs hundreds of dollars per night in just room fees alone, right? Most Puerto Ricans can't pay that or anything close to that, to be honest.
Yeah, 100%. I think one thing we need to keep in mind as well is as these beaches are privatized, like obviously they're going to start developing them. Like that's the whole thing that's happened at Guadilla, right? The developments, they're going to enclose them. They're going to build resorts. They're going to, you know, build additions to like the houses that are there to make it more palatable to like foreign visitors or whatever. And that's destroying like the ecosystem. That's destroying the natural, you know, like flora and fauna of the area. Like there's a whole section in San Juan that they showed pictures of that area like 5 years ago. And like, there's just been incredible beach erosion because they've just developed that edge of the beach there. And now like half of it is like underwater at like any given moment. So we could talk about like, oh, you know, it's, you know, xenophobic and blah, 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 because we don't want, you know, white people there or whatever. But like independent of that, this is destroying, you know, the ecosystem, the environment of Puerto Rico as well.
Specifically going into the beach erosion, right, there was this recent study about Puerto Rico's beaches saying that about 61 miles of coastline migrated inland after Hurricane Maria and Irma a couple years back. So we are seeing the natural erosion of these beaches with the after effects of climate change and global warming, right? We're seeing how the amount of space at the beaches that we have is becoming less and less every year, which is why many people want to fight against this development on the coast. Because, right, legally, pretty much every beach in Puerto Rico, except one, which is the Caribe Hilton Beach in San Juan, is, right, that one beach is the only one that's private. Everywhere else is public by law, and it has been that way for decades.
Time immemorial.
Exactly. So once you have these developments on the beaches, right, they start building so close to the beach that you, even if you could technically walk onto that beach, the beach no longer exists because it's like maybe a couple inches of sand, the waves, and then on the other side is the construction. Yeah. Right. So we're seeing how the beach migrates inland and that we're left without any place to enjoy publicly, which is why many people have started really emphasizing the maritime terrestrial zone, which is a law, right, that stipulates that there needs to be a certain space of beach that is legally public. It is, let me check my notes. It is 20 meters, right, that has to be for public use always in every beach except that one beach in Caribe Hilton, from where high tide is 20 meters after that needs to be public. And then 50 meters from high tide, you can't have any permanent structures. And the part of that is like an allowance for how beaches rise because of coastal erosion, right? And with because that is largely ignored by both the government of Puerto Rico when they're giving out these permits and by these developers, some who have permits that should not have been given and some who don't have the permits, we're seeing the loss of coast and the loss of places where you can just exist in public, right? And that's a thing that many people stress too, because we're right, Puerto Rico is very expensive and the beach is pretty much the only place where you can exist without having to pay, right? In San Juan, there was a recent attempt to block off five or seven parking spots that a lot of surfers used. And people were like, well, why, right? You're blocking this off because you want me to pay the $5 for parking. But like, sometimes I want to buy a sandwich and I don't want to pay the $5 for this parking. So, right, it is kind of a way of making people, and this is a thing everywhere, right? Making people not be able to exist outside of their own homes without having to pay a certain amount of money.
100%. And like what are we talking about here? Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you kind of stand back and like look at this, we're talking about these public beaches that, you know, Puerto Ricans have had access to forever. Trying to protect those, they come in and, you know, people fighting back, and then it ends up being but not this. And then it's sort of concessions constantly. And it's going to get to the point that unless something drastic changes, it's going to be the complete sell-off, the complete, you know, privatization of everything. And like, it reminds me a lot, if you ever go on a cruise like around the Caribbean, especially if you go to like Belize or Cozumel, whatever, you're not accessing where the people actually live. Like, the tourist areas are completely fenced off, and that tourism economy is completely self-contained within that, like, 1 by 1 kilometer area, you know what I mean? And like, because the tourists don't want to go with the locals, the tourists don't want to go with like the dirty brown people, you know what I mean? And that's slowly what it's becoming, as Puerto Rico gets fenced off and or Puerto Ricans are forced to leave the island, you know what I mean? We're at the hour mark here, so we'll start wrapping it up. But I think, Austin, unless you have anything else to add, I think my last question for you is, like, what do you see going forward for Puerto Rico? Like, what's your forecast? What would you like to see? And what do you think is actually going to, you know, happen as we move forward and within all of this that's going on?
Well, primarily, I would write the thing for me is that there's so much of what is currently going wrong in the archipelago that has already there have already been laws put in place so that these things happen, right? With the beach privatization, there's already laws that say that this shouldn't be happening. With the energy, right, a thing that we didn't get to touch on is, right, the cost of energy and how we're supposed to be moving towards solar by 2025. We're supposed to be 40% solar. And that, or 40% renewable. My apologies. And that we're not even close to that. And there's already laws that say we're supposed to go to that. And I think what I and any other Puerto Rican who's suffering because of this, what they just want is for these laws to be enforced. Right? It's not a lot of it. And people have told this to me. Right, they don't want new laws, they just want laws to be enforced. But instead they're seeing how like the police or the state security apparatus is used to aid in breaking these laws, as we're seeing in Aguadilla, as we're seeing at any time that people protest the beach, we see I was talking to an activist in Aguadilla when there were like 30 cops there, they were saying that you could rob a bank in Aguadilla because all the cops are here. you could just put a truck in front of all, where all the cops are, so the bikes and the cars can't get out, and then you could just do whatever you want in the town, right? I think that's what people want, that for the laws that are on the books to be enforced. And as far as what I think is going to happen is we're seeing, right, where I think about collapse a lot and how you don't realize that it's happening to you because you're currently living it. But I think that that is kind of where Puerto Rico is right now, in kind of an elongated sense of collapse that's kind of obfuscated,
protracted,
because
yeah.
we're living it, right? Because when if you kind of look at this from afar, you see people can't pay for food, people can't pay for electricity, the light, even if you could pay, the lights going out all the time, the roads are horrible, right? You're seeing the friction caused by this lack of, well, this lack of care for things that aid quality of life for regular Puerto Ricans. And you're kind of seeing these systems rub up against each other and fail. But the good thing, well, that there is a lot of suffering that has tragically happened and likely will continue to happen. But the thing about these places where friction forms is that good things can bloom in these spaces as well, right? We're seeing a fantastic amount of community organizations rise up to do the work that the government and the state isn't doing. People like environmentalists or renewable energy cooperatives or that type of thing going, well, if the state's not going to do it, then we might as well do it ourselves, right? And on a lot of places, they're really catching up to what a funded government agency is or could do, right? And I think that is a lot of what gives me hope, even though things are seemingly getting worse, right? The fact that even in the darkest times, people will come together to try to make things better for people that they might not know. Right. And I think that is kind of the interplay that we're seeing as, cause I don't want to go off on a super long tangent, but right, a lot of what people conceive of as the popular conception of Puerto Rico is just the Metro San Juan and the surrounding municipalities. Right. But I think that the most right, like politically radical and like, community radical things are happening in places that people would not think of where things happen, right? A lot of these rural municipalities or municipalities that people from the Metro only think as places to like vacation and is where a lot of the best things in Puerto Rico community and like community organizing wise are occurring.
That's very, very, very well put. And just a quick note on the renewable energy thing. If we talk about how poor Puerto Rico is and how it's falling apart, but if it has anything, it has sun, it has winds, and it has waves. You know what I mean? So this shouldn't be hard. You know what I mean? Like Puerto Rico should be in a place where it can actually export these things. But anyway, this is where we're at. But yeah, with that said, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, could I with that? I wanted to interject to talk about how it doesn't even need the wind or the waves. If like 60% of rooftops in Puerto Rico were outfitted with solar, we could provide energy for the entire archipelago, right? We have more than enough resources for the entirety of Puerto Rico to be powered by renewables. We just need for laws to be enforced or for people to start, and in many places people are putting solar panels on their roofs at cost to themselves, right? And we're seeing this mobilization towards renewable, and I think that is the thing that is pushing a lot of people towards being more open to certain things that they wouldn't have been open to before, right? If a person says, well, if my electricity bill is going down, I'm all for renewable, and that's the entrance into other more progressive political things that they might maybe not completely understand, but they might start imbibing and getting to know them more.
Carlos, where can people find you?
I'm at Vaquero2XL on Twitter, at Carlos Berrios Polanco on Instagram, and LatinoRebels.com. That's where I post pretty much everything I do. We're moving towards video and audio right now, yeah. So expect a lot more of that.
That's dope. But yeah, thanks for coming on. Again, you're one of our favorite people in the Puerto Rican activist space. Keep doing what you're doing, man. We'll keep putting and promoting your work out there to our gringo audience. That's they're probably the ones that need to see it so they can actually understand what's going on in their colonies. You know what I mean? But again, thanks for coming on, and hopefully we'll bring you back on soon to just give us updates on what's going on. Mi gente, thank you for listening to this edition of Machete Mate. If you support what we do, consider showing your solidarity at patreon.com/machetemate. You'll be helping us out by allowing us to put out more and better content while also getting access to our Discord community, our more casual and personal After Dark episodes, and any other projects we might have down the road. If not, we still love you, so show us some love with a good rating review on whatever platform you spend time with us. And as always, hasta la victoria.